I can see it in your eyes, like, oh, I made up my mind, I don't wanna waste no time, yeah.
Money making while we're breaking, it's amazing. California, celebrated or berated, it's been faded. California, Maria, the hills are swarming with dead ends and the bots performing. Don't mistake it, you can break big till you get sick.
Those days, so baby, let me love. DePose from The Faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz. Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
With the failure of last week's Summit of the Americas for President Biden, and with new caravans of migrants heading north of Mexico to the U.S. border, it's become more evident than ever that the harvest of empire is still with the United States. We will not be able to confront the growing migration crisis as other European countries also have migration crises until the countries of the West and the United States come to a reckoning with their centuries of colonial domination of the peoples of Asia, Africa, and Latin America.
Today, Democracy Now! Co-host, journalist, professor, and author Juan Gonzalez on Harvest of Empire, a history of Latinos in America. He's just updated his best-selling book that's in hundreds of classrooms and universities and high schools across the country. It uplifts the stories of people like the Guatemalan activist Rigoberta Menchú, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for helping to publicize the plight of Guatemala's indigenous peoples under the brutal U.S.-backed government.
Can it be that we will not be victims of genocide tomorrow?
Yo no tengo ninguna garantía.
I do not have any guarantees.
In Guatemala,
if what exists in Guatemala is persecution, murder, killing, if what you have is insecurity, then I prefer to cross the border and go to a place with more security.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A bipartisan group of senators has reached a watered-down agreement on gun safety that could lead to some new federal gun restrictions, as well as increased funding for mental health and school security. The plan would also provide funding to states to create red flag laws that would prohibit some people from owning firearms. The deal, however, does not include a ban on assault weapons or raise the age required to buy assault weapons to 21. It also does not establish universal background checks. In a statement, President Biden said, quote, "It does not do everything I think is needed, but it reflects important steps in the right direction and would be the most significant gun safety legislation to pass Congress in decades." The deal was reached by 20 senators, 10 Democrats, 10 Republicans. Negotiations began after the recent mass shooting in Uvalde, Texas, where 19 fourth graders and their two teachers were shot dead, and the massacre in Buffalo when a white supremacist attacked a grocery store, shooting dead 10 people, all of whom were Black. Both shooters were 18 years old. On Sunday, Christian Hayne, vice president of the gun control group Brady, praised the bipartisan deal.
We have not seen the likes of a framework like what we see in this package for the last 30 years. And I think, you know, it's significant not only because of how this can have a real impact in lives, but to me, it feels like a moment in time and a sign of things to come. Right. This is sort of testing ground that we can pass bipartisan gun laws and the sky won't fall. And for all of those reasons, I think that this agreement is really important.
The bipartisan Senate deal on gun safety was announced a day after hundreds of thousands of people across the country took to the streets to end gun violence. Thousands rallied in Parkland, Florida, where a gunman shot dead 17 students at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in 2018. Speakers in Parkland included 16-year-old Zoe Weissman, the president of March for Our Lives Parkland.
4 years later, we still have to march. We still have to fight for the basic right to safety, the right to go to school or synagogue or grocery shopping or work or a concert or home without being shot. Today, survivors and activists stand before you as we demand change. I am so proud of our community. Today, we will march with over 400 communities worldwide. Thank you for joining us in a fight for a world without gun violence. Thank you.
On Sunday, over 1,000 people gathered in Orlando, Florida, to mark 6 years since 49 people were shot dead at Pulse, a popular Latinx LGBTQ nightclub. Heavy fighting is continuing in the eastern Ukrainian city of Severodonetsk as Russia moves closer to seizing all of the Luhansk region. Just one bridge remains connecting Severodonetsk to other areas still under Ukrainian control. This comes as Amnesty International has accused Russia of using indiscriminate shelling and cluster munitions to kill hundreds of civilians in the northeastern Ukrainian city of Kharkiv. As Ukraine continues to press Western nations for more advanced weapons, Russia's claiming it struck a large arms depot on Sunday in Western Ukraine, where Ukraine was storing weapons sent by the United States and allies. 22 people were reportedly injured in the strike. In other news related to the war, a new report by the Center for Research on Energy and Clean Air estimates Russia earned nearly $100 billion in fossil fuel exports during the first 100 days after it invaded Ukraine. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, or SIPRI, is warning the risk of nuclear war is higher today than at any time since the height of the Cold War. In its annual report, SIPRI says the global stockpile of nuclear weapons is expected to soon rise for the first time in decades as the United States, Russia, China, France, and the United Kingdom move to expand or modernize their arsenals. The U.S. and Russia possess about 90% of the world's nuclear warheads. The House Committee investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection is holding its second public hearing today. Witnesses scheduled to testify include Donald Trump's 2020 campaign manager, Bill Stepien, and Chris Starwalt, a former top editor at Fox News. During its first hearing on Thursday, the panel accused Donald Trump of staging an attempted coup in an effort to overturn the 2020 election. Democracy Now! Will be live streaming today's hearing at democracynow.org beginning at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. The next hearings are during the day on Wednesday and Thursday. Democracy Now! Will live stream all the January 6th committee hearings. In related developments, The Washington Post is reporting Ginni Thomas, the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, pressed at least 29 Republican state lawmakers in Arizona to help overturn Joe Biden's victory in the state. Meanwhile, Trump's former personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, is facing new ethics charges from the District of Columbia Bar for spreading lies about alleged voter fraud in an effort to overturn Biden's election victory in the state of Pennsylvania. A court in Bolivia has sentenced former President Jeanine Añez to 10 years in prison after finding her guilty of orchestrating the 2019 coup that ousted President Evo Morales, Bolivia's first indigenous president. After the coup, Añez served as Bolivia's president for 1 year until November 2020. Añez, who's a former right-wing senator, was convicted of making decisions contrary to the Constitution. A former Bolivian army commander and police commander were also sentenced to jail for their role in the coup. Meanwhile, at the Summit of the Americas in Los Angeles, a protester interrupted a presentation last week by Luis Almagro, the head of the Organization of American States, over his support for the 2019 Bolivian coup.
Eliminate that impunity, and eliminating the impunity.
Luis Almagro, you have blood on your hands. Because of your lies, there was a coup in Bolivia, a coup against the democratically elected government, and that
President Biden spoke Friday on the closing day of the Summit of the Americas in Los Angeles. He unveiled a new plan to address migration.
20 countries coming together to launch the Los Angeles Declaration on Migration and Protection. With this declaration, we're transforming our approach to managing migration in the Americas. Each of us is signing up to commitments that recognizes the challenges we all share and the responsibility that impacts on all of our nations.
The Summit of the Americas was marred by Biden's decision to exclude the leaders of Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. The Mexican president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, boycotted the summit in response. The leaders of Bolivia, Guatemala, and El Salvador also skipped the gathering. In France, President Emmanuel Macron is fighting to keep his parliamentary majority after a strong showing by a left-wing alliance led by Jean-Luc Mélenchon. During the first round of voting in parliamentary elections, the blocs led by Macron and Mélenchon each received around a quarter of the vote. Marine Le Pen's far-right party came in third with just under 19% of the vote. Voters will return to the polls next Sunday for a second and final round of voting. Syria suspended all flights at the Damascus International Airport after an Israeli attack damaged the airport's runway and observation tower. Israel reportedly launched a volley of missiles from the occupied Golan Heights early Friday morning. Syria, Iran, and Russia condemned the attack. In recent years, Israel's quietly carried out hundreds of strikes inside Syria, targeting Syrian forces as well as Iranian-backed fighters. In Brazil, a search team has found items belonging to the missing indigenous expert Bruno Pereira and British journalist Dom Phillips. Brazilian federal police said Sunday they had found a backpack, laptop, and clothes in the Javari Valley, a remote portion of the Amazon where the two were conducting research. The area is one of Brazil's largest indigenous territories and home to drug trafficking, poaching, and illegal fishing networks. This comes after police reported finding traces of blood in the boat of a fisherman who was arrested last week in connection with their disappearance. In news on the COVID pandemic, Chinese authorities have begun testing 5 million people in the most populous section of Beijing after a new COVID outbreak at a bar that had just reopened from earlier restrictions had been lifted. Beijing officials have postponed reopening schools in parts of the city and placed numerous people under lockdown. In other pandemic news, the Food and Drug Administration said Pfizer-BioNTech's three-dose vaccine for children under the age of 5 is safe and effective. The FDA appears poised to soon authorize vaccines by both Pfizer and Moderna for young children. In Idaho, 31 members of the Patriot Front, a white supremacist neo-Nazi group, were arrested Saturday in the city of Coeur d'Alene ahead of a gay pride event. Police say the men were found packed into a U-Haul truck armed with riot gear. A tipster had called police saying they'd seen a, quote, little army being loaded into the truck at a nearby hotel. At a news conference, Coeur d'Alene Police Chief Lee White said the members of the Patriot Front were arrested on charges of conspiracy to riot.
They were wearing arm patches. One of them said Patriot Front. The majority of them had logos on their hats. They were consistent with the Patriot Front group that you would see online. They were also wearing khaki pants, and everyone was dressed exactly the same. Well, very, very similar anyway. And if you go online, look up Patriot Front, that's exactly how these individuals were dressed.
The Food and Drug Administration's acknowledged for the first time 9 children may have died after consuming contaminated baby formula made by Abbott Labs at the largest baby formula manufacturing plant in the nation in Sturgis, Michigan. Up until Friday, the FDA had only acknowledged the deaths of 2 children linked to a contamination outbreak at the Abbott plant in Michigan. A whistleblower at the plant sent the FDA a report detailing safety and sanitation violations by Abbott as early as February 2021. but it took the FDA a year to take action and close the plant. Meanwhile, baby formula shortages are still increasing in parts of the country, especially in the South and Southwest. Olympian Simone Biles and almost 100 other sexual abuse survivors have sued the FBI over its failures to promptly investigate Larry Nassar, the former Team USA gymnastics doctor. The FBI first received reports of sexual abuse by Nassar in 2015, but the agency failed to act for a full year, leaving Dr. Nassar free to continue his sexual abuse. In 2017, Nassar pled guilty to sexual assault, child pornography, and evidence tampering charges. He was sentenced to over 40 years in jail. Former University of Michigan gymnast Samantha Roy said, "If the FBI had simply done its job, Nassar would have been stopped before he ever had the chance to abuse hundreds of girls, including me," she said. Google's agreed to pay $118 million to over 15,000 female workers to settle a class-action gender discrimination lawsuit. The lawsuit accused Google of systematically underpaying women in California in violation of state law. Meanwhile, female employees at the software company Oracle are facing a new setback in their lawsuit against the company. On Friday, a judge stripped them of their class-action status. And retired Marine four-star general John Allens resigned as the president of the Brookings Institute. The FBI recently seized Allens' electronic data as a part of a probe into whether he lied about his role in secretly lobbying for the government of Qatar. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we look at what many are calling the failed Summit of Americas, which ended Friday in Los Angeles. We'll also look at the migrant caravan making its way to the U.S.-Mexico border, and so much more, with Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez, who's just updated his landmark book, Harvest of Empire, History of Latinos in America. Stay with us.
Immigrante. This is a country of immigrants. Gracias, hermano, por todo tu trabajo. Gracias, hermana.
Sola voy con mi pena, sola va mi condena. Correr es mi destino para burlar la ley. Perdida en el corazón de la grande Babilón. Me dicen clandestino por no llevar papel. A una ciudad del norte yo me fui a trabajar. Mi vida la dejé entre Tijuana y Bagdad. Soy una raya en el mar, fantasma en la ciudad. Mi vida va prohibida, dice la autoridad.
Un saludo de la peligrosa pa' la misteriosa por allá en México.
Lila Downs performing Manu Chao's Clandestino for Democracy Now!'s 25th anniversary celebration last year. Yes, this is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Some 7,000 people in a migrant caravan heading to the United States were dispersed by Mexican authorities this weekend as they approached Mexico City. Some of those seeking asylum told Human Rights Watch they'd sought protection in Mexico, but were dissuaded from seeking refugee status and were pressured to accept voluntary returns to their home countries. Many are from Central America, Venezuela, and Haiti. Some had children with them. Here in the United States, President Biden wrapped up the Summit of the Americas Friday in Los Angeles by unveiling a new plan to address migration in the Western Hemisphere that includes a series of so-called bold actions. This is Biden.
Coming together to launch the Los Angeles Declaration on Migration and Protection. With this declaration, we're transforming our approach to managing migration in the Americas. Each of us is signing up to commitments that recognizes the challenges we all share and the responsibility that impacts on all of our nations. Los Angeles Declaration is built around four core pillars. First, stability and assistance, making sure communities that are welcoming refugees can afford to care for them, to educate them in their education, medical care, shelter, and job opportunities. Second, increasing pathways for legal migration throughout the region, as well as protections for refugees. Third, working together to implement a more humane and coordinated border management system. And finally, making sure we're working together to respond to emergencies.
The agreement was signed by over a dozen countries in the region, including Mexico, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, even though their presidents did not attend the summit. The only Central American country that refused to sign was Nicaragua, which was excluded from the gathering by the Biden administration, along with Cuba and Venezuela. The plan includes a commitment from the United States to resettle 20,000 refugees over the next 2 years, even as authorities say more than 200,000 migrants, asylum seekers, and refugees approach the southern U.S. border each month. Customs and Border Protection, or CBP, reports a record 234,000 migrants and asylum seekers arrived at the U.S.-Mexico border in April alone. More than a quarter of the world's migrants are in the Americas, some 73 million people, even though the hemisphere accounts for only 12% of the world's population. This according to the International Organization for Migration. Millions are displaced in their own countries by poverty and violence. For more, we spend the hour with Juan Gonzalez, Democracy Now! Co-host, journalist, professor at Rutgers University, longtime broadcast and investigative journalist. On Tuesday, he releases this new revised edition of his landmark book, Harvest of Empire, History of Latinos in America, originally published in 2001, already a best-selling book and required reading in hundreds of colleges and high school courses. Juan, congratulations on the reissue of your book. It's great to spend the hour with you, not as co-host, but as the primary guest of today's show. With this epic work that you have added so much to in this latest edition, beginning on the issue of migration and how the U.S. treats migrants, asylum seekers, refugees on the southern border. Juan, take it from there.
Yes, Amy, thanks for the opportunity to go a little bit in depth into this new edition of the book, as well as to remind folks about what was in the earlier versions. I think the biggest thing that we have to understand is that this country has been grappling with what to do about immigration policy now for about 30 years and has not been able to come up with a refashioned immigration system in the United States. And every few years and every administration promises that they're going to do something about an orderly flow of migrants into the country. But the reality is that there's resistance and a huge battle over how migration will be governed in the 21st century, because we're really talking about who gets to be an American in the 21st century. So it really is an issue of who can legally come into the country and have an opportunity to be a citizen and a voter. And I think that what's happened is that we really have not come to grips with, as the title of my book says, the harvest of empire, that the reason there are so many Latinos and people from Latin America coming into the United States is that Latin America was the start of the American empire. It was where the first overseas colonies of the United States came into existence. It's where the United States constantly was intervening with its military forces, where most of the major multinational companies began to grow, companies like the United Fruit Company and others. Latin America was the incubator of the American empire. And so we are in a position, and we have been now for decades and decades, since really the end of World War II, We're in the same position that the French are in regards to North Africans, that the British are in relationship to their former colonial empires of India and Pakistan and Jamaica, and that the Germans are in their tiny empire that they developed toward the end of the 19th century in the Middle East, that all of these former colonial powers are trying to figure out what to do about the fact that so many people from their former colonies have come to the metropolis. And that is the fundamental issue that all of these Western countries are facing, the actual change in the composition of their countries. And when it comes to Latin Americans, it's astounding. I started writing this book in the 90s, and I even have been astounded by the continued growth of the Latino population of the United States. The latest census says that there are 62 million Latinos in the United States, the 2020 census. That's about 18.7% of the population. But even the Census Bureau acknowledged that that's an undercount, that they undercounted about 3 million more Latinos that they should have counted. It was the largest undercount of any group in the census. And that doesn't count the 3.2 million people in Puerto Rico, which is not considered part of the United States, but is under the U.S. flag. So if you add the 3 million from Puerto Rico and the 3 million undercount, you're talking about 70 million people of Latin American descent under the U.S. flag. That's about one in every five people in the entire country. So this increased, and when you look at the young people, that's where the real stunner is. California is about 40% Latino, but the public schools of California are 54% Latino today. The public schools of Texas are 52% Latino today. The public schools of Arizona are 45% Latino today. When you go into the southern states, in Georgia, the Latino population is 10%, but the population of the public schools is 16%. In North Carolina, it's 18%, the Latino public school population. This is the future of the country. And so I don't think that we really have yet grasped how the impact, the unintended harvest of the American empire is coming to roost right here in our own country. And that's why the political leaders are having so much trouble trying to figure out how to develop a comprehensive immigration and humane immigration policy.
So Juan, you begin your book by saying in June 2018, media reports revealed U.S. Border Patrol agents had detained hundreds of Latino children inside chain-link cages at a warehouse in the southern Texas border city of McAllen. The disturbing images of terrified toddlers wailing for their parents provoked the worldwide condemnation. I just want to play that audio, just a few seconds of it, that ProPublica released. That crying rocked the world and at the time exposed the Trump administration policy, the policy of zero tolerance. Yet we are under the Biden administration. Talk about what happened then and what has changed.
Well, there has been some slight changes of the Biden administration, especially in the attempt by the Trump administration to shut down legal immigration or asylum. There's been some changes in there. But the problem is that there still is no legal framework for dealing with the migration situation today. And we're not talking just about the issue of undocumented versus documented workers. We're talking about visas for guest workers. We're talking about asylum numbers, which the United States should rightfully increase substantially. The numbers that it permits of asylum or refugees into the country. So that we don't have a clear framework to deal with the current conditions of migration in the hemisphere and in the world. But I think the even worse part of it, and this is where in my updated edition, because again, my last edition came out in 2011, so this really deals with all of the changes, and there are many changes that have occurred in the Latino experience in America over the last 10 years. It updates those. Let me just give you one startling fact that I came across in doing my new research, right? In 1998, two-thirds of all arrests by federal government agencies in the United States were of U.S. citizens in 1998. Two-thirds were of U.S. citizens. 20 years later, in 2018, two-thirds of all the arrests of federal agencies in the in our country were of non-citizens. The entire federal law enforcement bureaucracy has been turned into a persecution operation for non-citizens. In 2018 alone, the federal government arrested more Mexicans than it did American citizens. They arrested more Mexicans than they did American citizens. That's an extraordinary change in the operation of the federal government. The budgets. The U.S. in fiscal year 2021 spent $26 billion in immigration enforcement, in the budgets of ICE and of Customs and Border enforcement, $26 billion. That's more money than is spent in all its other federal law enforcement agencies, the DEA, the FBI, the ATF, the U.S. Marshals Service, and the Secret Service. All of those agencies spent less money than did Customs and Border Enforcement and ICE. So the entire federal government apparatus has been turned over the last 10, 15 years into an apparatus hunting down, deporting, locking up immigrants. And we're not just talking about undocumented, because there are all of the people who were legally in the United States, but then were some time or other convicted of what the government called aggravated felonies and then were deported. Right? So there is a repression and deportation machine that has developed at the federal level against and they're mostly people from Latin America. Here's another startling fact that I came across in my research. Between 2010 and 2017, the United States deported 1.5 million people who were either legally in the United States or undocumented, and they were convicted of a crime or an aggravated felony. And by aggravated felony, we're talking about almost anything, a DUI under the Clinton Penal Code reforms was an aggravated felony. 1.5 million people deported. Of those people, 93% came from only four countries: Mexico, Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. 93% of the 1.5 million people deported came from four countries. The rest of the world was the other 7%. Even though people from those four countries only represented about a third of all the non-citizens in the U.S. That's racial profiling. How do you come up with 93% of all the people you deport because they committed a crime come from only four countries? The entire apparatus is geared to kicking out Latin Americans, no one is doing anything about it.
And you have this summit of the Americas right now, Juan, where all sorts of controversies, widely considered a failed summit, where the president's spokesperson says he won't meet with autocrats, won't meet with Nicaragua, Venezuela, and Cuba, ends up, what's his big meeting in Los Angeles? With Bolsonaro, with the autocratic ruler of Brazil, who's already preparing, and now the Brazilian military is preparing to say that the elections there will not be legitimate. And Juan, by the way, there's this breaking news that's coming out of Brazil right now. We have been reporting on the indigenous advocate and journalist who have been missing in Brazil. Well, Reuters just broke this information that the bodies of the British journalist Dom Phillips and indigenous expert Bruno Pereira, who've been missing for more than a week in Brazil's Amazon jungle, were found Monday. This is according to Phillips' wife, Alessandra Sampaio. So he meets with Bolsonaro and Mexico, as you're talking about. AMLO, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, refuses to attend because of the U.S. imposing who can come to the summit of the Americas and who can't. Also, El Salvador, Honduras, Bolivia, none of those countries, and Guatemala come, other presidents come either.
Yes, well, I think that this Summit of the Americas is really the complete failure of the Biden administration to be able to show a united front in Latin America. It's really it's really a reflection of what has changed geopolitically in Latin America. And in my new edition, I touch on that somewhat, which is that Latin America is no longer the U.S. backyard. It used to be. It used to be during the days of Teddy Roosevelt and gunboat diplomacy, and even into the 1930s and 40s, and even in the 60s with President Kennedy and the Alliance for Progress. But Latin America has changed dramatically. And one of the big changes, of course, has been the rise of popular movements outside of the established political structures that long reigned in these countries, and the movements of indigenous people and marginalized people in these societies, and the working class in this society. But the other big change has been the rise of China as a major force in Latin America. While the United States was off fighting wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and trying to maintain oil supplies and dealing with Syria, and China was investing in infrastructure in Latin America, building huge multi-billion-dollar dams and tunnels and ports. And providing low-interest loans to many Latin American governments. And so these governments no longer feel they have to do what the United States says. And increasingly, the region is no longer a region dominated by one power. And as a result, now many of these governments feel that they can reject loans from the United States or demands of the World Bank, because there's an alternative source of funding. Now, of course, China has its own desires in terms of its grabbing hold of future sources of raw materials. But but the Chinese aid does not come with all of the military threats and all of the insistence that things be done China's way that the United States has practiced for so long in Latin America. So as a result now, there's room to maneuver among the leaders of the Latin American countries. And you're seeing it happen. You saw it happen at the Summit of the Americas last week.
That's right. And you have this, The Hill reporting China, which by now has held three China-Latin America ministerial forums at the level of foreign ministers, has called out the United States for discriminating among Latin American countries, pointing out Washington is stuck in a Cold War mindset.
Yes, absolutely. And we're seeing it now, for instance, in Venezuela. We had the ridiculous situation that the Washington still recognizes Juan Guaido, the opposition leader in Venezuela, as the legitimate president of Venezuela, when the reality is that for several years now, it's been clear that whatever criticisms there may be of Maduro as the president of Venezuela, and there are many, that the Venezuelan opposition is so fractured and so impotent that it has no capacity or ability to run Venezuelan society. And of course, the United States now, because of the war in Ukraine, is even trying to create new chances for negotiations with Maduro in Venezuela in order to secure more oil supplies for the U.S. Well, not for the U.S. so much, but certainly for Western Europe because of the war in Ukraine.
Juan, we're going to break and then come back to this discussion. Juan Gonzalez, Democracy Now! Co-host, but also professor at Rutgers University, longtime broadcast and investigative journalist, two-time winner of the George Polk Award, one of the co-founders of the Young Lords, and author of a number of books. His book, Harvest of Empire, A History of Latinos in America, originally published in 2001. Its second revised edition, more than 20 years later, is being released on Tuesday. Back with him in a moment.
Siempre hubo madrugadas para la noche más fiera. Siempre una primavera borró una huella invernal. Siempre hubo mariposas para la flor más ajena y para una vida en rejas habrá al final libertad. Siempre el puño del pueblo tiró gigantes al suelo, siempre con la sonrisa venció la mueca feroz, siempre con el amor el odio pierde terreno. Pues hay que ganar terreno pa' cimentar el amor. ¿Y qué dirán los que te engañaban viendo una patria crecer mañana? Le pedirán, Puerto Rico mío, la compasión. ¿Y qué dirán cuando la bandera, la borincana...
Always with Puerto Rico, by Amuari Perez Vidal. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Our guest for the hour is our co-host, Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez. Yes, professor at Rutgers University, longtime journalist, award-winning investigative journalist, author of a number of books. His latest coming out tomorrow is Harvest of Empire, History of Latinos in America. Now, if you've grown up in this country, you may well have been in one of the high school or college or university graduate school classrooms that have used this book. But its second revised edition is being released Tuesday. This is his first major broadcast interview on the latest book. And Juan, in your new introduction, you talk about the use of the term Latinx.
Yes. Well, as we know, and on Democracy Now!, we use the term quite often. Latinx has increasingly grown as a term to define the people of Latin American population here in the United States, but the reality is that a 2019 poll shows that only 3% of all Latinos used the term that year, and only 23% had even heard of it. There was a similar battle that arose some years back, more than a decade ago, over whether it was more appropriate to use the term Latino or Hispanic. I took the position then that I thought that these discussions about the most appropriate term were more debates among the intellectual class than they were among the masses of the people. The masses of the people generally refer to themselves by whatever nationality their parents were, and of course in the case of indigenous people, by their own native heritage. The reality, though, is that both Latino and Hispanic I began to use interchangeably. And of course, given that Latinx addresses the the gender binary that I thought that it's definitely a welcome term to use, but I continue to use them into all three of them interchangeably. And in fact, I say in that introduction, I just wanted to see if I can find it for a second to explain. I say, moreover, most migrants from Latin America still prefer to identify themselves by their particular country of origin, or in the cases of indigenous peoples, by their native heritage. Their U.S.-born and raised children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren will increasingly adopt different views. Ethnic identity, after all, is a social construct, much like racial identity. It requires a dynamic and fluid approach, not a static and rigid one, with every generation free to reimagine and redefine its own place in society. Though the actual economic and social conditions of any community should always take precedence over labels and intellectual descriptions. And that's the so I use all three terms, Latinx, Latino, and Hispanic interchangeably. None of them are precise and accurate. All of them are acceptable in my perspective. And the most important thing is not the term or the label. It is understanding the class and racial and social condition of the masses of the people and how they can improve their lot in society.
Juan, you also have new information about culture and how Latinos, Latinas, Latinx people are portrayed in this country. And you refer to Lin-Manuel Miranda. Now, last night were the Tony Awards, and the Latinx actor, composer, writer, Lin-Manuel Miranda, honored Stephen Sondheim. But I want to go to him at the Tonys in 2016, because June 12th, Sunday, marked the sixth anniversary of the 2016 Pulse nightclub mass shooting in Florida, where 49 people were killed. Pulse was an LGBTQ+ club, most of the shooting victims Latinx. Lin-Manuel Miranda delivered a sonnet about the Orlando attacks at those 2016 Tony Awards. His Broadway hit Hamilton had won 11 Tony Awards that year. This is Lin-Manuel.
When senseless acts of tragedy remind us that nothing here is promised, not one day. The show is proof that history remembers. We live through times when hate and fear seem stronger. We rise and fall and light from dying embers, remembrances that hope and love last longer. And love is 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 love cannot be killed or swept aside. I sing Vanessa's symphony. Eliza tells her story. Now fill the world with music, love, and pride. Thank you so much for this.
That was Lin-Manuel Miranda in 2016, also spoke last night at the Tony Awards. Juan, talk about how Latinos, Latinas, Latinx people are portrayed in the media, in culture, in movies, in shaping the perspective of this, the largest minority community in the United States.
Yes, well, I mean, there's no doubt that probably the largest impact that Latinos have had in the country is in the realm of culture, whether it is in the music that we listen to, in the books that we read. In the case of Lin-Manuel, in his almost single-handedly beginning to revolutionize the American theater, and I think that that this sudden infusion, you know, I often say that Lin-Manuel Miranda is probably the biggest jobs producer for African-Americans and Latinos in theater in the history of the United States, because his two seminal works, In the Heights and Hamilton, as they are produced in regional theaters around the country, end up employing huge numbers of actors in all of these places, and often for long runs. So he's become a jobs creator just as because of the popularity of those two shows and the impact that it's had on the class composition of theater goers is phenomenal. Not to mention the fact that he's almost helped to revolutionize how you teach American history to public school children. So I think that, but Lin-Manuel is just one of many young performers and artists that are really transforming American culture, because to the degree that Latinos become more a part of the society and intermarriage occurs between Venezuelans and Cubans marrying in Miami, and their children have this new Latino identity, whether it's Salvadorans or Mexicans in Los Angeles or Puerto Ricans and Dominicans in New York. The intermarriage and the amalgamation of these various Latino cultures, and then Latinos also marrying and intermarrying with African Americans and white Americans, you're creating a whole new amalgamated culture in America, and with a strong Latinx infusion that I think is enriching the culture and diversifying the culture in ways that we really haven't grasped yet. But I think Lin-Manuel is probably the prime example of someone who is leading the transformation of American culture.
Juan, I wanted to go back to a clip of the 2012 documentary based on your book, Harvest of Empire, that talks about the history of U.S. imperialism in Latin America. In this clip, the involvement of the U.S. in the Dominican Republic, where many of the immigrants here in New York City hail from, the clip prominently features the Dominican-born Pulitzer Prize-winning author Junot Diaz.
The American nation cannot, must not, and will not permit the establishment of another communist government in the Western Hemisphere.
I'm here because the United States invaded my country in 1965, an illegal invasion, completely trumped up excuse to invade the Dominican Republic and crush our democratic hopes. We've lived the consequences of that illegal invasion politically, economically, and in the bodies of the people who were wounded, the bodies of the people who were killed. We've been living it for over 40 years.
There have been two major U.S. occupations of the Dominican Republic. The first was in 1916. The U.S. Army trained a new Dominican National Guard. It handpicked a former railway security officer, Rafael Trujillo, to lead that guard. And Trujillo then uses the power of the military to seize control of the government.
He was like the most horrific imagination of this terrifying dictator. He would disappear Dominican and American citizens and kill them with impunity.
He basically ruled the Dominican Republic for 30 years with absolute, total control. He routinely kidnapped and assaulted the wives, even of his supporters.
And throughout his career, made it extremely easy for American companies to do business in the Dominican Republic, but was a savage, savage dictator.
Eventually, even the United States government could not stomach his methods of operation, so the CIA joined with disgruntled military officers to back his assassination.
For the first time in 30 years, the people of the Dominican Republic are breathing the sweet air of liberty, and the streets are jammed in celebration.
Dominican Republic last in 1965. From the 2012 documentary based on Juan Gonzalez's book, Harvest of Empire, which was directed by Peter Goetzels and Eduardo Lopez. But I want to also go to a second clip. This features the indigenous Guatemalan Nobel Peace Prize winning Rigoberto Menchú.
Guatemala fue tremendo.
Guatemala was unbelievable. 200,000 dead that we have accounted for. 50,000 disappeared. 83% of the disappeared and executed were Mayas. I left Guatemala after they burned my father alive in the embassy of Spain. They were asking for political asylum from the Spanish government. They were trying to save their lives by entering the embassy. But at that moment, the Guatemalan security forces attacked the embassy. They burned everyone alive. No one survived. Not the students, no one who was there. If what exists in Guatemala is persecution, murder, killing, if what you have is insecurity, then I prefer to cross the border and go to a place with more security.
That was the Nobel Peace Prize-winning indigenous leader, Rigoberta Menchú. Juan, we have about 3 minutes left. From Dominican Republic to Guatemala to El Salvador to Honduras, take us out with this history that so few people in this country understand.
You know, I think it's especially instructive seeing this clip on the Dominican Republic, because that's an invasion, a U.S. invasion that most Americans don't know about or never taught about, but yet was critical in the shaping of that nation. It was actually the second U.S. invasion of the Dominican Republic. There was one in the early 20th century. But I think it's especially instructive since we're now in the period when everyone is concerned about the war in Ukraine. What was happening in the Dominican Republic was that leaders had come to power, were trying to overthrow a military dictatorship, and the United States perceived them to be allying with another bloc, as President Johnson said, the communist bloc. And that was seen as a threat, even though the Dominican Republic itself was no threat to the United States. And repeatedly, our troops have gone into Latin America to overthrow governments or to stop popular revolutions, only because we didn't like what was happening there, not because those countries were a threat. And yet here we are criticizing Russia for daring to invade Ukraine because its leadership wants to be closer to another bloc, to the West. The same logic that our country has used over and over and over again throughout the history of Latin America. And I think it's instructive for us to understand that this great power imperialism was trademarked and established. The model was established in Latin America by the United States. And that's why, as I say in my book, this is the unintended harvest of the empire. The empire expected just to take resources and wealth. It never expected so many of the people of these countries it was exploiting to come to the metropolis. That's why we need to fashion an immigration system that takes into account that history, the wealth inequality that we have fostered, and the violence and the arms that we have supplied to those countries, try to fashion a more humane immigration policy for the future in the United States.
Well, Juan, congratulations on this epic, sweeping work that looks at centuries of Latin American history and relates it directly to what we experience in the United States today, and particularly around the issue of immigration. We thank you so much, Juan, for all of your work. Juan Gonzalez, Democracy Now! Co-host, professor, longtime journalist, author of many books, including the landmark, now reissued and out on Tuesday, Harvest of Empire, A History of Latinos in America. It's the second revised edition. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
RCT, the in sound from way out.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with photojournalist David Bacon, who documents the racist water crisis in California's San Joaquin Valley.
This is climate change coming home to strike.
We are fortunate to have with us our own co-host of Law and Disorder, Heidi Boghossian, but in the guest seat, to talk about the move away from passwords and toward biometrics and increasing governmental surveillance.
I'll be talking in depth about some of the pros and the cons of biometrics and exactly how widespread they are.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org. California has a water crisis that is rooted in racism. About 1 million Californians in 130 communities still do not have access to clean, safe drinking water. Most of these people live in rural areas, primarily populated by farm worker families. This inequality can be traced to the great migration of African Americans from the South to the North at the beginning of the 20th century. Met with discriminatory real estate practices, they were forced to build or rent homes in colonias with no water mains, sewer lines, or lighting. That racist legacy continues to plague people, primarily of Mexican descent, who live in San Joaquin Valley, one of the richest agricultural areas in the world. Growers who pump large amounts of water from the soil are at the top of the chain when it comes to water access. Next come residences and businesses. At the bottom of the water access chain are the residents of the colonias. But the people are organizing, and they have achieved a victory in their decade-long struggle for equal access to water. Photojournalist David Bacon has documented this shameful inequality and the legislation the people have secured in his article, The Color of Water, which was published in April by The Nation and the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. We are lucky to have David here with us today to discuss the racist water crisis in California. David Bacon is an author, political activist, and former union organizer who has focused on labor issues, particularly those related to immigrant labor. He is senior fellow at the Oakland Institute and the author of several books and numerous articles. His most recent book is More Than a Wall, Más Que un Muro, which documents the communities on either side of the Mexico-U.S. border in photographs and journalism. David Bacon, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Good to be here, Marjorie. Thanks for inviting me.
Please explain how people in the small colonias of California's San Joaquin Valley don't have access to safe